Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum, a series of talks and interviews with writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm John O'Brien. Today we present best-selling author Tom Robbins as he returns home to tell some mostly true stories. He'll read from his new memoir, Tibetan Peach Pie, a true account of an imaginative life. It starts with 5-year-old Tommy Rotten forcing his mother to take dictation and leads to a very good Tom Clancy impersonation. In 1962, Robbins made a break from Richmond, Virginia to try his luck in Seattle. He calls our fair city back then a magical metropolis wrestled from moss, mildew, and mud. For over 50 years, that spark has kept him tethered here to the Northwest. Tom Robbins spoke at Town Hall Seattle on June 26, 2014. Town Hall and Elliott Bay Book Company presented this event as part of the Arts and Culture series, sponsored by City Arts. Please be advised, the following program contains some language of an adult nature.
Who are these people? Thank you so much. I flew out of SeaTac on May 24th, and I've just been home a few days. And I can't tell you how sweet it is to be back in this spectacularly mildewed citadel of big-hearted anarchy and joy. I've been on the road on behalf of this book that I swore I would never write. And it probably is correct to call it a memoir. Although if you were to ask me to tell you what writing a memoir is like, it would be like, if you were to ask me to talk about memoir, I think it's like would be like asking a recently deflowered virgin to talk about sex. I've just been kind of stunned by the whole experience. I have this feeling of euphoria and disbelief and titillation, confusion, exhaustion, fear, and no little shame. But I am going to read to you from it with your permission. And I'm going to start fairly close to the beginning, actually around page 7, back in my early days. So, throughout most, maybe all, of my childhood, my mother's pet name for me was Tommy Rotten. I used the term pet name advisedly, for though it had been born in perplexity and consternation, it was invariably spoken with affection, and sometimes actually with a kind of ill-concealed admiration. But lest anyone be tempted to characterize Tommy Rotten as a prototype of Bart Simpson, and I do detail on these first 6 pages some of the many acts of mischief I committed that led to this nickname. Let it be known that for all my reckless and usually hedonistic mischief, I was as much a Lisa Simpson as a Bart. That is to say, I was cursed with that gene that causes children thusly afflicted to exhibit overt signs of sensitivity, to go around creating stuff, drawing pictures, putting on puppet shows, banging on the piano, and in extreme cases, to behave as if the thermostats on their imaginations were set permanently on high. It was almost as if some mad literary fairy, hatched perhaps in a poppy in Oscar Wilde's garden, had tapped me with her wand as I lay in my cradle, because I fell totally in love with books as soon as I knew what books were. and I hadn't been talking in complete sentences for many months before I announced to my parents that I intended to be a writer. Too impatient to wait until I could spell words and scrawl them on paper, I turned my mother into my private secretary. When the muse bit me, as she did rather frequently, being indifferent to child labor laws, I'd call on mother to stop whatever she was doing and take dictation. The fact that she was so willing to comply may be attributed to the fact that mother herself was a frustrated writer. At 18, she'd been offered a scholarship to Columbia University, but had been too frightened to move to New York. It was doubtlessly her sublimated literary ambition that prompted mother to occasionally change the wording of my dictation to improve, in her opinion, my prose style. However, I always remembered each and every sentence I'd spoken and would throw a tantrum until she restored my wording verbatim. When in 1975 I recounted this to Ted Solotaroff, my editor on Even Cowgirls Get the Blues, he exclaimed, "My God, Robbins, you haven't changed in 40 years." In any case, when for my fifth birthday I was given a Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs scrapbook, I began filling it not with pasted pictures, but my dictated and unedited stories. The very first of those stories, and the scrapbook still exists, was about a pilot whose plane crashed on a tiny desert island, a barren place whose sole inhabitant was a brown cow with yellow spots. The cow had survived by learning to gastronomically process sand. In time, it taught the pilot to eat sand as well. And they lived there together, man and bovine, in friendship and good health. So what meaning can we take from this first attempt at literature? That fortune favors those who improvise? That we humans have much to learn from animals? That we should insist on joy in spite of everything? The fact that the pilot didn't rather quickly butcher the cow and commence cooking it up, thereby ensuring his starvation when the meat ran out, was that an object lesson in sustainability? A prophetic fable intended to encourage future generations to seek alternatives to the greedy, thoughtless consumption that one day would threaten to suicide the planet? You'd have to ask little Tommy Rotten. And he wasn't talking. As mentioned, I started writing fiction at age 5. Hardly an overnight success, however, I didn't get published until I was 7. I attended a large consolidated school, grades 1 through 12, in the same 3-story building. There was a biweekly school newspaper, edited and almost exclusively written by juniors and seniors. Well, I had recently composed on notebook paper, the Snow White scrapbook having long since been filled, a rather melodramatic story featuring a reckless boy, a courageous dog, and a dangerous waterfall. So one day during recess, I trudged up to the 3rd-floor newspaper office, slapped the story down on the surprised editor's desk and said, "Print this." It appeared in the next issue. And I thought, that was easy. Maybe I could do this for a living. Well, eventually I did do it for a living, but a lot of jelly ran through the donut before that came to pass. It was a long and winding road with many dramatic curves and sharp turns. And one of those turns occurred in 1962, when after having gotten into a bit of trouble for some unorthodox activities in support of civil rights, I fled racially conservative, repressive Richmond, Virginia, and moved to Seattle. I forgot to mention that just before leaving, I married a woman I literally did not know, but that's another story, not for tonight. But Susan and I arrived in Seattle on a Friday afternoon following a cross-country drive that lacked only a team of sled dogs to successfully recreate a scene from Nanuka the North. From western Pennsylvania to eastern Montana, old man Winter had a stick up his butt, punishing animal, vegetable, and mineral alike with lashing winds, deadly low temperatures, and a great suffocation of snow. Unaccustomed to driving on ice, I braked abruptly at the lone stoplight in Perham, Minnesota, and went skidding into the rear of a farm truck. The truck shrugged it off, and the damage to our Valiant was largely cosmetic, but the collision caused an air vent under our dashboard to stick open, permitting swirling snow, mile after mile, to blow up my pant leg. By the time we'd traversed North Dakota, the family jewels were so frozen they wouldn't have looked out of place on Michelangelo's marble statue of David. Eastern Washington, while considerably more benign, was nevertheless chilly, its brown fields lightly dusted with snow. But once we crossed the Cascades and began our descent into Seattle, there had been a dramatic shift, meteorologically and chromatically. It was like being gulped down the open throat of an emerald. A famous Italian journalist once began her interview with Muammar Gaddafi by asking the Libyan dictator if he had a favorite color, to which Gaddafi replied, "Green, green, 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 green," on and on, over and over for nearly 5 minutes, she said, before she could get him to stop. The interviewer thought he was crazed, but I think he was just channeling Seattle. Seattle, the mild green queen, wet and willing, cedar-scented and crowned with sloughgrass, her toadstool scepter tilted toward Asia, her face turned ever upward in the rain. The sovereign who washes her hands more persistently than the most fastidious proctologist. These days, Seattle is not radically dissimilar to other large cities in California or back east. But in 1962, it was a magical metropolis, rested from moss, mildew, and mud, animated more by chainsaw and chi than by commerce and chutzpah. And although I would miss Richmond and miss aspects of it still, I was thrilled to the bone to have landed in this clam-chawed outpost where one might mix metaphors with impunity, bathed in oyster light beneath skies that resembled bad banana baby food. That darkening afternoon, watching Seattle's hills begin to sparkle as if mounds of damp silage was being set upon by a trillion amorous fireflies blinking Morse code haikus that no Virginia cockroach could appreciate or understand. My heart informed my head that I had found my new home.
Stay tuned for more true stories from novelist Tom Robbins. Coming up, a particular transforming experiment. For KUOW 94.9 Seattle and Speakers Forum, I'm John O'Brien. Welcome back to Speakers Forum on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Tom Robbins found his unique voice in 1971 with the publication of his first novel, Another Roadside Attraction. In subsequent years, he's developed a cult following for his best-selling work. The New York Times calls him a moonbeam of the counterculture. Robbins' new memoir is Tibetan Peach Pie. When we left off, Tom Robbins was falling in love with Seattle. Next up, leaving his body to explore a daisy.
About 2.5 years later, something even more dramatic happened in my life, caused an even more profound turn of events. Something metaphysical and spiritual. And, well, let me say this. In July of 1964, I ingested a substantial amount of a substance known as lysergic acid diethylamide 25. Now, I had never been high on anything. I'd never smoked pot. I'd consumed alcohol, of course, but the effects of alcohol are almost diametrically opposed to the effects of a psychedelic. So it was a transformative experience for me. I mean, it really changed me in a lot of profound ways. But I did not know a single other person who had taken LSD. So I had no one to talk to about it. I would mention to someone, you know, I took these three blue pills, and if Khrushchev and John F. Kennedy were to take these together, the Cold War would be over in 20 minutes. And people would just look at me and shake their head, you know. And when I would mention that, you know, the other day, I left my body and went inside of a daisy. And people would just roll their eyes, you know, and walk away. So I felt isolated. And I knew there were other people somewhere in America who had had this experience, and I wanted to find them. I felt like a nation of one, a one-man tribe. I wanted to find my fellow tribesmen. And so with that in mind, a couple months later, I moved to New York. I should have gone to San Francisco. If my objective had been to connect with like-minded people and to fraternize, perhaps on a regular basis, with other travelers home from the rabbit hole, moving to New York was a mistake. Granted, there were individuals in Manhattan who had taken or were taking psychedelics, but few in number, they flew well below the radar. And even though I lived just up the street from the iconic Peace Eye bookstore, where I mingled with luminaries of the Beat Generation and befriended Allen Ginsberg, I never established contact with my presumed kin. Whereas, in San Francisco, in late 1964, there was an infestation of white rabbits, and they were multiplying like, well rabbits. A radical new music, a mixture of surfer rock, southern blues, Berlin music hall, and Indian raga, with far-out lyrics, was spilling into the streets around Haight and Ashbury. The city's younger citizens were dressing as if every day was Mardi Gras, and Chronicle columnist Herb Cain would soon be coining the term hippie. An incandescent acid rain was sprinkling San Francisco, but Tommy Rotten, oblivious, had fled the thin gray rains of Seattle for the dirty snows of New York. He hadn't heard the California weather report. But as I look back now, I see that my ignorance had been a stroke of luck. In San Francisco, I could have been sucked into the developing psychedelic scene. A scene, man. Could have been caught up in the looming politics of ecstasy. Another 60s comet chasing his own bright tail. Aside from my conviction that for maximum benefit, the forbidden fruits of LSD are best savored in solitude, the psychedelic experience, as I said, was emphatically nonverbal. And after more than a year, during which I was as suspicious of verbiage as of a big-mouthed car salesman with dyed blonde hair and three ex-wives, I was, secluded in my New York tenement, beginning slowly to fall in love again with wood pulp and ink. I don't think they were reading all that much down in the Hate. At age 5, I'd hitched my little red wagon to the language wheel, that disc of verbiage that came rolling out of the grunting and growling mud of prehistory, accumulating variations and refinements beyond number as it rolled headlong into literacy, and, when greased with imagination, into poetry, into theater, ballads, sutras, and rants. I believe LSD's pre-literate, post-literate juggernaut had run me off the road. I'd believed myself stranded there. But now, Hermann Hesse had driven up in a vintage Mercedes tow truck, its radio blaring Mozart, and winched my wagon out of the ditch, demonstrating in Steppenwolf that modern narrative fiction indeed could transcend bourgeois preoccupations, and with both an enlightening and an entertaining panache, as playful as it is deadly serious, bind spirit to matter and insinuate for readers those hidden worlds within our world. Das ist gut. So I checked my load. The cargo appeared intact. Transformation, liberation, and celebration. Exotica and erotica. Novelty, beauty, mischief, and mirth. The goods I'd been hauling around for damn near 3 decades, all present and accounted for. If anything, psychedelics had cleaned them up a bit, given them a shine. This was encouraging, but having yet to find a literary voice of my own, and not wishing to imitate Hesse, or, for that matter, anybody else, I was to bide my time for nearly 3 more years before I trusted the muse enough to start my first novel. In the meantime, however, like a lapsed believer returning to the fold, I commenced to reaffirm my devotion to language, that magical honeycomb of words into which human reality is forever dissolving and from which it continually reemerges, having invented itself anew. The adjective in the lotus, the jewel in the inkwell, a blue dolphin leaping from a sink of dirty dishes. Thank you. As I waited to find my voice, I moved back to Seattle. And one day I had another spiritual, metaphysical experience from an even more unlikely source. In 1966, I was renting a spacious apartment, 7 rooms and bath, for $50 a month. Why so cheap? Situated in an industrial area of Ballard, the apartment occupied the second story above a machine shop. Apparently, few readers considered that a desirable location. I, on the other hand, found it as appealing as a Manhattan penthouse. The shop, you see, manufactured gears. Gears have to be ground. So rather than a cacophony of clanking and banging, the noise from below my quarters was a low, slow, steady, grinding hum, not unlike the turning of the screw on a ship. It was soothing, comforting, and even kind of romantic, a perfect soundtrack for both lovemaking and a good, peaceful sleep. On those occasions when the gearworks had a rush order that compelled it to grind around the clock, I experienced difficulty in getting out of bed in the morning. I could have blissfully slept all night and all day, and sometimes when I did force myself to arise, I'd walk to the window, half expecting to see expanses of ocean, and in the distance, a silhouette of, say, Tahiti, or maybe Santa Catalina, whose waters would eventually swallow Natalie Wood. Well, nobody wants influenza, but when I was hijacked by a virus in January of 66, I took consolation in the fact that I'd get to recline in my warm bed for several days and be lullabied by the sweet humming of friendly machinery. Moreover, I had a good book to read. I Lost It at the Movies was a collection of reviews by legendary film critic Pauline Kael. Ms. Kael was one of those rare critics whose passion for her subject was contagious. Just as Henry Miller's write-in on Matisse was evocative and enrapturing to the point where it could make the reader willing to walk 10 miles naked through a storm if there was a chance at the end of viewing a painting by Matisse. So reading Pauline Kael gave one a raging appetite for movies. It's a credit to the virus that I managed to resist for 4 days before abandoning my sick bed to head to a theater. In those pre-mall, pre-multiplex, pre-Netflix days, and I didn't even own a television, first-run movie theaters tended to be clustered in city centers. Thus, I slid behind the wheel of my decrepit Plymouth Valiant and set out for downtown Seattle. It was winter, as I said, and I hadn't driven far along Elliott Way before running head-on into a full-fledged blizzard. Snowfall of this magnitude is rare in Seattle, whose winters are typically mild and rainy, but this baby might have sent Admiral Byrd retreating into early retirement. Snow was blowing directly into my windshield, reducing visibility, though it was early afternoon, to practically zero. Except for roiling snowflakes, I could see nothing beyond the hood of my car. Now, there used to be a driving range and putting green on Elliott Way, advertised by an elevated sign depicting a large white golf ball. The painted golf ball was outlined in three-dimensional white neon. As I crept along, squinting into an animated curtain of swirling, spinning snowflakes, there unexpectedly appeared in this dynamic white vortex a glowing white circle. A seed, a cell, a head, a halo, a tondo, a corona, a bodily orifice, a zodiac wheel, the sun, the earth, the moon, the eye, and the egg, the unbroken cycle of life, the continuity of consciousness, the mysterious silver flower of the soul. That neon golf ball was all of those things and none of them. And as I glimpsed it, suspended and radiating within an energized field of sparkling flakes, white on white, I suddenly understood everything. everything. I saw how the universe worked, how it was put together on every level, macrocosmic and microcosmic, for as long as it lasted. And it was over, I'm guessing, in a dozen seconds. In that state, time was elastic / geologic. I was witness to an indissoluble totality of reality, a gestalt which normally our monkey minds split into convenient fragments. The rigid fetters that bind us to simplistic dispositions, absurd rationalizations, self-destructive ideologies, and divisive worldviews was severed, and I was free spirit in the oneness of the whole enchilada, seeing the world, material and immaterial, for the all-inclusive miracle it is. Not a continuous, undifferentiated glob of stuff, mind you, but more like a great spiraling web whose interconnected threads are beaded with pulsing blips that, as much as anything else, resemble notes of music. Now, I'm all too aware of how woo-woo this sounds, but it was as real as a stubbed toe and as lucid as a page in Hemingway. Had I been Asian and of a certain temperament, had I been the Japanese Tom Robbins, I would have repaired to a zendo, an ashram, or a wilderness cave to meditate upon my neon golf ball, Satori, for the rest of my life, striving to integrate it somehow into my daily existence. Instead, although shaken, galvanized, and fairly splish-splashing in a fading aura of awe, I just motored on through the subsiding snow squall and went to a Hollywood movie. The film, incidentally, was The Group. It chronicled on screen the lives and loves of a bevy of Vassar girls. Pauline Kael would later dismiss it as carelessly busy.
Coming up, Tom Robbins shares stories that prove his writings can lead to unusual circumstances. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien. Welcome back to the last segment of tonight's Speakers Forum with Tom Robbins. In it, fiction meets fact in a case of mistaken identity.
When someone from the Seattle office of the FBI telephoned one Thursday in 1995 to say that the agency wished to question me, I knew immediately, though no reason was given, what it was about. I knew because a month earlier, a newspaper reporter in Connecticut had contacted me to report that a college professor in that state was telling law enforcement agencies that it was obvious from what Tom Robbins had written in Still Life with Woodpecker, the anti-authoritarian sentiments, the warnings against overdependence on technology, the romanticizing of outlaws, and most tellingly, authentic recipes for homemade bombs, that he, me, was the Unabomber, subject of a nationwide manhunt. The journalist thought it amusing, considering both the humor and passionate reverence for life that also permeate the novel. And I myself paid it little mind until the Bureau phoned. Even then, I wasn't troubled and pleasantly agreed to receive an agent at my LeConnor home on the following Tuesday. But then, the very next morning, as synchronicity, that boundary-busting, logic-mocking clown, would have it, Susan Paintner, a columnist for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, published in her Friday column the widely circulated drawing of the Unabomber in his hooded sweatshirt and dark glasses, juxtaposed with a recent headshot of me. in a hooded sweatshirt and dark glasses. The resemblance was hard to miss. Could our Tom Robbins, she wrote, who wouldn't hurt a fly, be the infamous Unabomber? Susan, who knew me, meant it as a joke, but I assumed they weren't laughing very hard down at the FBI. My assumption was correct. On Tuesday, without once asking for directions, the agents arrived at my door. Two of them, young, female, attractive. The FBI is not stupid. They knew my weakness, and the agents knew I now knew they knew. That established, we settled in for a lengthy chat, during which they never once intimated that I myself was under suspicion, but were only hoping that I could provide them with leads to follow up on. Leads such as any fan mail I might have received from a reader who'd professed, perhaps in the Unabomber's prose style — he had published several extremely long missives in the New York Times — an inordinate admiration for my woodpecker character and his habit of punctuating social commentary with dynamite. Leads such as my source for those unusual explosive recipes, the bomb made from Kitty breakfast cereal, for example, that I'd included in the novel. Entirely professional, the women raised not a pretty eyebrow when I answered that, alas, I'd hauled an accumulation of answered fan mail to the county landfill only a week before, and that, sorry, I couldn't remember the name of the Seattle sound system engineer who, through an intermediary, also forgotten, had passed along those instructions for turning common household products into things that go boom in the night. I was certain, however, that I could detect something subtle, unspoken, pass between them when I unwittingly volunteered that I'd physically demolished the electric typewriter on which I'd begun composing Still Life with Woodpecker and had gone back to writing with a pen, an obvious Unabomber-like retaliation against technology. And then, when I asked them where they were from and they both said Chicago, I'd blurted out that I'd spent time in the Chicago area myself. True enough, it was where I'd once attended weather school, but it was also where the Unabomber posted most of his deadly packages. For whatever Tommy Rotten reason, I was doing a pretty good job of incriminating myself. In addition to which, I caught the agents on several occasions eyeing the nutty, cartoonish assemblage of sticks and twine I'd constructed to support a tall, spindly yucca plant in my studio, a contraption that could have led a suspicious mind to equate it with the jerry-built devices the Unabomber mailed to his intended victims. When the Fed Fems left that day, I was convinced I'd not seen the last of them. And something perverse in me was actually excited by the prospect, by the drama of it all. And when months passed without a word from my agents, I went so far as to telephone their office in Seattle to inquire how the investigation was going. I just couldn't help it. A cold, dead, robotic voice informed me that the agent I sought did not work there. I asked for the other woman and got a similar response. No explanation was offered. Curious. Very curious indeed. Who were those women then? Who was their actual employer? What did they really want from me? My imagination, that infernal pinball machine, lit up. and I had a truckload of quarters. Then, around Christmas, I received a holiday card from one of the agents, the one with whom I would have flirted more openly had it not seemed somehow in poor taste. She wrote that she and her sister investigator had been transferred to Oklahoma City to work on the federal building bombing case there. I wrote back, but she never responded. And eventually the Unabomber was caught, and I ran out of quarters. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. So if you'll indulge me, I have one more story for you. Although I'd found my first three books to be generally satisfying from an artistic perspective, and though they'd attracted a loyal following among readers who discovered a slice of Tibetan peach pie to be their just dessert, after far too many predictable potlucks of good old meat and potatoes American social realism, how many protagonists can one watch come painfully of age? How many bad marriages resolve or dissolve? And after a while, who really gives a damn if the butler did it? Despite those early successes, I don't think I hit my stride as a novelist until Jitterbug Perfume. Thank you. Published in 1984, it remains, aside from Still Life of Woodpecker, my most popular novel, perhaps because it explores from a fresh perspective the pervasive human yearning to somehow transcend the cycle of birth and death, and dramatizes without sentimentality the possibility of an eternal romantic love. Jitterbug Perfume was followed in 1990 by Skinny Legs and All, a novel inspired not by the Joe Tex tune from which I took the title, but by a fascination with the biblical bad girls. Delilah, Jezebel, Bathsheba, Lot's horny daughters, and most especially Salome, upon whose so-called Dance of the Seven Veils the book is systematically structured, the dropping of each veil signifying the casting off of one of the illusions that limit human advancement. Set in modern times against the backdrop of the New York art world, Skinny Legs and All explores the Jewish-Arab conflict from both an interpersonal and a mythological perspective, and shoves so many pies in the collective face of fundamentalist apocalyptic Christianity that, considering the violent nature of some true believers, I thought it might be a good idea to accept the invitation I received that June to travel to Moscow with a high school marching band. The opportunity was provided by my friend Lee Frederick, a basketball star at Bradley University who went on to coach in college and with the Detroit Pistons. Lee had given up coaching to form Sports Tours International, a specialized travel company that organizes tournaments and takes U.S. collegiate sports teams to play and soak up a little culture in Latin America, the Caribbean, and Europe. His clients are mostly basketball and volleyball programs, but he had once organized an overseas tour for a chess team, and now he'd been hired to take to Russia a champion high school marching band from New Richmond, Wisconsin. He wondered if I'd like to come along. Well, yeah. Lee and I hooked up in Amsterdam, where I sometimes go to take the waters. And flew to Moscow together on Aeroflot. His staff had been in Russia for some weeks, and everything was organized. The Wisconsin group arrived in Moscow the same day as Lee and all of us were quartered at a quite large and quite bleak Soviet chic hotel on the outskirts of the city. That evening, in a dining room nearly the size of Stalin's paranoia, Lee spoke to the assembly and introduced his staff to the band, its directors, and its entourage. There were 75 kids in the New Richmond Marching Tigers, and it seemed as if every other one of them had a chaperone. At one point, I stood and was introduced simply as an American writer, with no hint that I might be on the run from Jerry Falwell. The following day, the band, all 75 uniformed members, assembled on the hotel grounds for a brief rehearsal. It was at that point that I noticed the drum majorette. She was hard to miss, very tall, very blonde, striking in her white boots, plumed cap, and short skirt, commanding in the way she twirled, tossed, and caught a baton. She was obviously the prettiest girl in school, the reigning social queen of New Richmond High. And as I admired her teen queen confidence, her regal bearing, her polished moves, I decided to have a little fun. During a break, I sidled up to her and with a stern expression said softly, "I know I was introduced last night as a writer, but," lowering my voice another octave now and glancing furtively over my shoulder, "but I'm actually with the Central Intelligence Agency. And my assignment here in Moscow is to protect you." I paused for her to take that in. "And in public, you will be on my radar at all times. In private, should you ever detect anything even vaguely threatening, my room number here is 804. Her blue eyes, naturally large, seemed to widen to the circumference of Frisbees. But before she could utter a word, I turned on my heel and strode away. All that week, as the band marched through Red Square, Gorky Park, and along Moscow's broader boulevards, tootling, tooting, trumpeting, and generally blasting Jesus Christ Superstar, its signature number, amazing, baffling, or sometimes obviously disgusting the Russians who had never seen or heard anything remotely like it, I, too, marched along. Off to the side, over in the gutter, but staying always abreast of the drum majorette, careful to match her stride for stride. From time to time, I'd catch her eye and nod ever so discreetly, indicating that the situation was under control, that I had her back, and by the second day, she would acknowledge me with her schoolgirl version of a conspiratorial smile. Our relationship, if it could be called that, it was much a prank as a flirtation, progressed no further, as well it shouldn't have. I was in my 50s, she 18, and surrounded at all times by a battalion of such sturdy, cheese-fed, vigilant Wisconsin chaperones that could have prevented King Kong from getting within an arm's length of Fay Wray. So, nothing came of it, except that for years now, somewhere in middle America, a former drum majorette has been reminding her husband and her children that in Russia, she had her own CIA agent. "Is that for real, Mom?" one of the kids will ask, and she'll slowly crank up that old clandestine smile and answer, "Yes, it's true. He had a beard and was kind of cute." his name was Tom, and I guess he also wrote books on the side. And in his English lit class, her oldest son will tell the teacher, "My mom used to be guarded by Tom Clancy." Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you, thank you. You're a lovely audience. I would have expected no less. So happy to be here with you tonight. And I think at this juncture, you're going to be allowed to answer questions, and I'm going to see if I can evade them skillfully or perhaps answer them somewhat truthfully.
So if you would like to ask a question, we ask that you do come to these two microphones on either side, well, one of them. And we have about 15 to 20 minutes, after which you can get a book if you haven't, and Mr. Robbins will be signing on the other side.
Can you tell us how you came up with the name for the book, Even Cowgirls Get the Blues?
No. I have no idea. I know that I started with the title before I wrote a line of the book.
Okay.
I think the idea first came to me in a feed store in Bellingham, where the very attractive clerk who was wearing high boots and really looked like she spent her off-duty time as a cowgirl, and I don't know, it just went from there. I'm sorry I don't have more.
And I had one other question. It seems to me I heard or read at some point around the time you wrote Skinny Legs at All that you never edited what you wrote. You just wrote it out and that was it. Is that true?
Well, that's a bit misleading. It's true that I only write one draft. However, I write so slowly and try never to leave a sentence until it's as good as I think I can make it. I'm really editing as I go along. So I set myself a goal of 2 pages a day. Some days, if I'm writing dialogue, I may exceed it. Some days, I don't get 2 pages. Some day, I don't get 1 page. But I will change words, and sometimes sentences, and occasionally even a paragraph in preparation, in progression. But pretty much when it's done, it's done. I don't do 2 drafts or 3 drafts, as many writers do. And when I'm on page 1, I don't really know what's going to happen on page 2. When I begin a book, I have a vague idea of a plexus of effects that I know I want to leave the reader with by the end of the book. But how I get there is another matter. I take my research, and I do a lot of research. I take my life experience, my education, my imagination, my sense of humor, pack them into a little canoe, and push it out into the dark and savage waters and see where the current takes me. So I'm very much engaged with every sentence that I write, but I have to surround the act of writing with an atmosphere of adventure or surprise or even terror in order to go do it every day. I was on a panel once with John Irvin, who mentioned that he would never begin a book unless he knew the last sentence. He had to know everything that was going to happen before he started. And I said, "John, I mean, that isn't that like having a job? Isn't that like working in a factory or an office? I don't know how he does it. It would bore me to rigor mortis."
Thank you very much for the great books. I see on your shirt A motorcycle. Do you ride?
I did. I used to ride motorcycles, but this is not the best climate for it. And I had a few too many close calls, so I gave them up some years ago. But I loved the image of a rider on a bike so much that I started buying toys, not meaning to start a collection, but I now have over 80 toy motorcycles with riders.
Thank you very much.
I don't know what this says in Japanese, because I'm not the Japanese Tom Robbins. I suspect that it says, "Out of my way, Yankee dog, or I'll run you down with my Kawasaki." So, you're next. I don't.
I read all of your books. I read all of the articles that I could find that you wrote. And I want to tell you that I'm about to publish my first novel through St. Martin's Press, and I want to say thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I wish you the luck I wish myself. And I'm glad that reading all of my books hasn't apparently caused any brain damage.
Hi. Yes. I really admire your facility with cultural references, but I'm wondering how you think about that in terms of how your works will be seen in the future.
Well, I don't know. I never think about people reading my books in the future. I hope the human race will have progressed further along this evolutionary path.
What year did you first publish Another Roadside Attraction? What year was it first published?
Another Roadside Attraction was first published in 1971.
Well, I guess 1972 then. I had a party from dusk till dawn because I'd gone from being a librarian to a dancer. And to that party came a fellow with a book signed by himself, Plunky Purcell. His book was tied with a handkerchief and a men's necktie. Do you still know Plunky Purcell?
Do I still what?
Know Plunky Purcell?
Oh, Plunky Purcell.
He said he was a character from the book.
Plunky Purcell was an entirely fictitious character.
Oh! I love it!
I don't know what you were doing prior to seeing him.
Well, that's great. I want you to know that tie got me going, and now I do a lot of artwork with ties, pillows and capes and different things. And I have like 5,000 ties now, and his was my first one, whoever he was.
That's great.
So you have one of my favorite interpretations of the meaning of life that I read more than a few years ago, and I was wondering if you have any updates to that. Have you figured anything else out?
I had, but tonight I seem to have forgotten it all. What I have come to think I know is that it's all, and I mean all, cosmic theater, a grand and goofy and ephemeral show. And paradoxically, each of us needs to play our role to the best of our abilities, while at the same time not taking ourselves too seriously.
I love your shoes.
I was up all night crocheting these shoes.
When did you stop being afraid of your writing?
Repeat, please.
When did you stop being afraid of your writing?
When did I stop being afraid of
your writing?
I don't know why I can't hear it. I think 60 years of loud rock and roll has done something to my hearing. It never entered my mind to be afraid of my writing. I mean, I started at age 5, and I guess if I was going to be scared, it would have happened by then.
So no answer for a struggling writer.
Well, I'm not saying that it's easy. It's hard work. But I'm certainly not afraid of it. Even on the days when it doesn't come easily, and there are those days. But I show up in my writing room every morning at 10 o'clock, and my muse knows where to find me. She doesn't have to go look in the bar or drag the strip. She knows I'll be there. And if it's a day when the juices aren't flowing, I will sometimes read passages from a book by a writer whose prose style I envy, and that will motivate me to get started. But you should never underestimate envy as a motivator.
So you said in 1964 you took LSD. Where in the world did you find it, and what possessed you to take it?
Well, I did not find it under a toadstool. Although toadstools played a part in it, I actually was led there, like many other people, by Life magazine. Life magazine published a rather long article about a man named R. Gordon Wasson, who was a Wall Street financier who had married a Russian woman who taught him to lose his microphobia, his fear that many Anglo-Saxons have of mushrooms. And he became so interested in them, he became somewhat of a pretty reputable amateur mycologist. And he heard about these mushrooms down in the Oaxaca area of Mexico and went down and, to his credit, went into a hut one night with a brujo and ate some mushrooms that he described later as creating a kind of wakeful dream state in which he saw jeweled castles melting in the air, and yet and all sorts of other things, and his rational faculties were fully operative at all times. I mean, he was not hallucinating. He knew that they weren't real, but yet they seemed as real as anything else. And the brujo, who gave him the mushroom said, you Yankees talk to God, we talk with God. And the mushroom is our line of communication. So after I read that, I thought, this could be valuable to me in my own quest for meaning. My own could be something to propel me along my spiritual path. So naively, I called up the biology department at the University of Washington. And there was a man there who had written a field guide to Northwest mushrooms, and he seemed like a logical source. So I said, I just read about these magic mushrooms that make you see jeweled castles in the air and talk with God, and I would like to get my hands on some. How can I do that? And he professed to have no interest whatsoever in that kind of mushroom. But before he hung up, he gave me he forwarded my call to someone in the pharmacology department. And he said, anyone can help you. This man probably can. Well, I was writing, I was an art critic for the Seattle Times at that point in my life. And this man, who was an MD and with a PhD in pharmacology, was also a Sunday painter. And he read my column every week. And so he said, let's have lunch. So we met for lunch, and we talked a great deal about art, because that was his sphere of interest. And then at the end of lunch, I said, now, about these mushrooms, I really want to get my hands on some of these mushrooms. And he said, no, you don't. I said, oh, but I do. He said, no, there's something much better. He said, you know, in the mushroom, the psychotropic components vary not only from season to season, place to place, but mushroom to mushroom. You just cannot accurately gauge a dosage. It's very crude. But there's this other substance manufactured in Switzerland called lysergic acid diethylamide 25, which will take you just as far and be a much smoother journey. And I said, okay, how do I get hold of those? And he said, I think we should meet again in a couple of weeks. So we met again for lunch because he wanted to make sure that I was psychologically sound enough to handle this substance. And finally, after another long lunch, he agreed to provide me with some. And one Tuesday, when I was supposed to be on my art beat for the newspaper, I went to the painting studio that he kept in Wallingford and sat in a easy chair from which I did not arise for 8 hours, except to walk to the bathroom once, and Homer could not have written an Odyssey more eventful. And so that was that.
Just one more question. Do you still commune with God that way?
Pardon?
Do you still commune with God that way?
Do I still?
Do you still occasionally?
Well, you know, if you have the real thing, you have the good stuff, you don't need to do it very often. I mean, that first experience, I mined the nuggets from that for years. Now, I have had a few refresher courses, but I have never taken psychedelics recreationally. I cannot imagine the kind of the brain who would find recreation in an experience like that. Thank you.
All right, we only have time for two more questions.
Over here. I thought I'd see if you recognized your cowboy shirt.
What?
You donated it. So very good. Thank you. Yes, thank you. Yes. Right. Right. Yeah, you still have it. Very good. I have a question, though. I want to know if you think Seattle has lost its soul.
Has Seattle lost its soul? Well, the truth of the matter is, you know, Seattle has never had a lot of soul. It's had a lot of heart. It has a huge heart. But, like, I grew up down south where the cities have a lot of soul, but no heart at all. So I think it's a pretty good trade-off. And, you know, the city isn't totally without soul. I mean, there's a soul in the Central District, for example. And here and there. But I don't think Seattle will go down in history as a great soulful city, but I hope, and I truly believe, a city that that is truly heartful. And I think should be proud of that. A lot of bad stuff comes out of some of those cities with a lot of soul. So, you know, a big front has a big back.
When I read Jitterbug Perfume, I wondered how a sweet boy from the deep south found himself in Bohemia. My folks are from Moravia. Where did you, do you have any recollection of how you got the character in the middle of Eastern Europe? The character that started in Bohemia? How did you find yourself in Bohemia with your character?
I hate to end this with saying I have no idea. I mean, I was thinking about the Middle Ages and thinking about Europe, and Bohemia just seemed the perfect place for those people to begin their long odyssey through space and time.
Thank you for writing that.
Well, thank you for reading it. Thank you all so much. Thank you. Thank you. Wonderful audience. I need to say a couple things about the signing. In past years, I have always made it a practice to sign each and every book anybody brought up to me, sometimes even when I didn't write them. And I would write any message that anyone wanted, and sometimes they were rather long. But I've been on tour now for a month. Some of my events have lasted more than 3 hours. And I turn 82 years old next month. So I frankly don't have the stamina to do that. So tonight, we're going to have to limit this signed books to the new book only. However, if you have some of the backlist books, some of the older books that you would like signed, mail them to me, and I will write in them whatever you want and send them back, and I'll pay the return postage. Well, thank you again. Wonderful.
Back in 1997, Tom Robbins won the Golden Umbrella Award for Lifetime Achievement in the Arts at Bumbershoot. He'll be there again for a reading this Sunday, August 31st. Robbins plans to read aloud the openings of each of his novels. He writes, "Thus, my appearance at Bumbershoot would provide a survey, a summation of sorts, of my life, literary and otherwise, in this damp thigh of the woods." Tom Robbins spoke at Town Hall Seattle on June 26, 2014. Town Hall and Elliott Bay Book Company presented this event as part of the Arts and Culture series, sponsored by City Arts. If you enjoyed tonight's talk, you'll find it and many more on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. We post each new episode on the Friday following the broadcast. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.